All right, Wednesday morning Bible study on Revelation. We're going to start in, we're going to work in chapter 13 today. We'll do all of chapter 13. But I want to do a little more thorough recap than usual, a few extra minutes rather than just a real quick skimming of chapter 12, just to kind of get us caught up, because there's a few interesting things that happened back in chapter 12. First of all, if you'll remember, I know there was a few of you who weren't here last week, but most of you were. Let me get the computer screen going here. There we go. Chapter 12 is the start of our third vision of the end times, and this is a different timeline, this vision, because it starts all the way back in creation. Rather than most of the first two visions, and the next vision, in fact, start after Pentecost, or after the Ascension, I should say, the Church Age. They're basically the New Testament era. That's what the first vision, the second vision, and the fourth vision encompass, that time frame. This third vision, starting in chapter 12 and it goes through 14, pardon me, starts at creation. And you remember what it showed, what St. John had a vision of, what he was seeing? He saw the woman who was going to bring forth a child. And the woman represented
Mary,
on one hand, it represents Mary in a very real sense, but in a broader sense, it represents whom? The church, God's people. The Old Testament people or the New Testament people at various points in the vision. So the woman, he sees the woman, and she's pregnant and about to give birth. That's what she sees. The God's Old Testament people, we'll call them the church of the Old Testament, are being moved to bring forth the Messiah. We know the child is the Messiah. And who else appears in this vision that St. John has, starting in chapter 12 last week? Who else appears in the vision? Or what creature?
The dragon.
Satan. That's right. He, St. John, sees the dragon. And who does the dragon pursue first of all? Who's the first target of the dragon that he's trying to pursue?
The baby.
The baby, right. The baby, the Messiah. He's trying to get the Messiah. So we see all of that going on in that first paragraph of chapter 12. So that's all back at starting at creation and through the Old Testament. That Satan's primary target throughout the Old Testament was to disrupt the line of the Messiah, to prevent the Messiah from coming, to prevent the Savior from coming. And then, after she gives birth, verse 5 in chapter 12, she gave birth to a male child. Of course, that's Christmas. One who is to rule over all the nations with a rod of iron. When does he become victorious over all the nations? Good Friday and Easter Sunday. So there's Easter right there. He becomes victorious. He becomes the ruler of all things. And then the next phrase, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Well, there's the Ascension. So in chapter 12, verse 5, we have the entire life of Jesus smushed into one verse. Christmas, Easter, Ascension. His earthly life. And after that happens, then what does the dragon do? Well, verse 7, war arose, and Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon, Satan, is thrown out of heaven. Now, do you remember, and there's a handful of you who weren't here last time, I found this pretty profound. Because I always thought that Satan was cast out of heaven after creation week. You know, the fall of man, back in Genesis chapter 3. But it's not true. Satan was cast out of heaven after Jesus' ascension. Right here, that points to that. And there's a few proof texts we use to point to that. Because we know in Job, for instance, we know in Job, Satan is conversing directly with God over Job. And, you know, Satan says, you know, he's accusing Job, oh, he's not a faithful, and God says, oh yeah, go ahead and test him, only so far and no farther. And Satan tests Job, and Job remains faithful. Okay, in a nutshell, that's the story of Job. And then we also look at Zechariah. And I forgot the verses. Perhaps some of you have it handy. Where in Zechariah did we look? I'll find it in my notes here real quick. Zechariah 3, verses 1 to 5. Again, we see Satan conversing directly with God. We also know from a couple of passages that Jesus speaks during Passion Week, where he says he sees Satan being cast out of heaven, in the present tense. He sees Satan being cast out. So, based on four texts, we kind of, I would call them proof texts almost, to say that prior to Jesus' ascension, his victory on Easter and his ascension into heaven, prior to that point, Satan had access into heaven. We know he's a fallen archangel. He could go freely into heaven and down on earth prior to that point. And what did he do in heaven? He accused us. He accused us of great crimes, sin, crimes of sin. That's what he did to Job. That's what he did in Zechariah. And then, after Jesus is victorious on Easter Sunday, and he ascends into heaven on ascension, and then we see here in chapter 12, verse 7, Michael and his angels fight against the dragon, and the dragon is cast out of heaven. Never more to have access to God the Father. Never more. He's completely cast out. Well, what happens if he loses access to heaven? He can no longer go before God the Father in order to accuse us of our sins. He can no longer do that. Remember, Satan means accuser. That's one of the natures of the devil. So where does his terror and wrath now focus after that point?
On us.
On us. Yeah, exactly. On us. He roams about the earth like a lion seeking whom he can devour. And so I found that pretty interesting. We talked about that for quite a bit. That's the verses 7 through the end of the chapter talks about that. Well, not only do I want to recap all of that, because we're going to pick up at the end of that. This chapter 13 flows right from chapter 12. They're really all one part of the same story. Okay, the same vision. Well, the same vision, of course. But something I didn't point out last week. Look at this illustration from the Luther Bible. It's a woodcut. Luther, I don't remember who, Albrecht Dürer, or I think, is the one who did all of these. When Luther translated the Bible into German, they had a picture for each book of the Bible, and a few other pictures in there as well, and they were woodcuts like this. They would carve it in wood, and then they'd press it on an ink pad and press it in the Bible. You know, it's very nice to have some pictures in the Bible as well. This was the one that is associated with Revelation. I've been using it as kind of the cover page on our PowerPoint here. Well, this is chapter 12. I didn't point this out. Who is this right here? Wings. He's got the cross on his helmet. He's got a spear. That's Michael, the archangel. That's Michael, the archangel. And who's under his feet? Well, there's a dragon right there. And he's about to be skewered by that spear. So that's war between Michael and the great dragon right there. So that's the depiction, that's the picture for the book of Revelation in the old Luther German Bible. How many of you still have a Luther German Bible? A couple of you? I'm impressed. I didn't think anybody would.
A German Bible?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You can't think for stay.
Yeah, I can't think for stay either.
Yeah, well, it's usually from your mother or your grandmother.
Yeah, right. You know? Right, exactly. All right. So, let's see. Now, so where chapter 12 ends is, I'll read the last verse. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So see, the end of that war between Michael and Satan, the dragon, Satan is kicked out of heaven, he's barred from heaven, and so now he makes war on the woman, which is the church, God's people. He makes war on the woman and the rest of her offspring. Who are the offspring of the church? You and I, right? Individually. All those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Right there. That's us, very clearly. And then, I know we didn't really touch on this last final short sentence in chapter 12. And he stood on the sand of the sea. I don't remember which class it was last week, but asked about, well, what does that mean? And I said, well, really, that's part of chapter 13. It's transitioning into chapter 13, because when the Bible was written, there were no chapter and verse numbers. It was just all written as one large narrative. Yeah.
I have a question on chapter 12.
Sure.
Verse 5 that you talked about, you know, she gave birth to the male child.
Uh-huh.
At the end of that, it says, her child was caught up with God. No. The woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which she is being nourished for 1260 days. I'm guessing that's our time in the world.
Right.
And I was just wondering if there's a significance to this number.
There is. Were you at one of the classes last week?
Yeah,
at the evening.
Okay, maybe I wasn't clear or didn't talk about it. I don't know.
Yeah,
1260, 1260 days is 42 months, which is 3.5 years. And if you remember a chapter ago, those three numbers all came up in chapter 11. 3.5 years, 42 months, and 1260 days. So two times ago, we talked about that a little bit extensively, about what those numbers mean. And there is some dispute. Different scholars think they mean different things. But the one that I think is the most makes the most sense is the number 7 being a number of completion, especially a completion of time. 7 is the length of a week. So if you think of all of human history on earth as 7, starting from creation and going till judgment day, if that's 7, Christ was here on earth in the midpoint, not exactly necessarily, but roughly in the center of human history. So 3.5 years is a reference to the second half of human history, which would be the New Testament age. The first 3.5 years being the Old Testament age. So in 42 months, there's some significance in that. That's the time of wandering in the wilderness. From the time the Israelites crossed the Red Sea till they entered the Promised Land was 42 years. I know it says they wandered for 40 years, but it took them 2 years to get to Mount Sinai and then to get to the Promised Land. And then God punished them for not believing him and not going into the Promised Land by 40 more years. So it was 42 years that they were homeless in the wilderness. So I think that's what this is a reference to. This is the church kind of being homeless for the church New Testament age, because we're almost underground. We fled into the wilderness. We're not yet at home with God. We're not at home in the world. We're being chased and persecuted by the forces of the devil, which we are. So we're constantly on the run. So yes, I think the 1260 relates to all those numbers in chapter 11, which refers to the New Testament age. So yes. So does that answer it? Okay, good. Yeah, Bob.
Bothers me about the devil, the angel, the devil. In other words, now we come up with this that he was not cast out back in the time of Genesis.
Right.
Well, as far as I know, all the Lutheran Church, everyone was under the assumption that the devil was cast out. Now, all of a sudden, that isn't so. But where were all these Lutheran scholars for all these years?
Maybe when he was cast out of heaven the first time, he just wasn't allowed to live and reside there. He could maybe come visit, but not be a part.
Possibly. I can tell you, Bob, until I started studying for this Bible study, I also, as a Lutheran pastor and a lifelong Lutheran, had the impression that Satan was cast out of heaven back in Creation Week, Genesis chapter 3. That was my impression. However, I will say this. I had never heard anyone teach on the subject. I never heard a pastor, one that when I was growing up, my confirmation pastor, ever talk about it. I had never personally been through a Bible study on Revelation prior to studying in order to teach you this season, okay? So I had never gone through Revelation on my own. I never heard a seminary professor talk about it. So I'm not going to say that the Lutheran Church had the belief that that Satan was cast out in Genesis, because actually there are some scholars, some of our Lutheran scholars from the time of Luther and on, who recognize and teach that Satan was cast out when Jesus ascended into heaven and war arose between Michael and the great dragon, as chapter 12 points out. I think that is the historic position of our church. I think that many pastors and professors and other leaders in our church have just not taught about it. They've been silent on it. It's frankly, it's not a big deal. Who cares, right? Who cares? And unless you're studying Revelation, you won't hear that particular detail about Satan being cast out when Jesus ascended into heaven. You won't hear that detail unless you're in the book of Revelation. And how often are we in the book of Revelation? Not very often. It comes up a few times in the lectionary. Actually, I think it comes up about four times in the lectionary, so that's about it. So
you can't say, well, this is one theory, or this is, it could have been this way, and it could have been the way we always had it thought about it before.
Sure. If we do some study, I mean, there are some early church fathers, too, back in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century, who also attest to this passage from Revelation, to say that that's when Satan was cast out. And there are four proof texts, which I referenced, which kind of help support this idea in Revelation. So it's not just the book of Revelation. In Job, in Zechariah, and two places that Jesus says, all point to the fact that the devil, prior to Jesus' victory on Easter, the devil had free access into heaven. And it wasn't until after Jesus was victorious over him on Easter and on Ascension that he was cast out. Yeah, it is kind of strange, because I've never heard about it one way or another, and I always had the assumption that when God pronounced punishment upon Satan, you shall, you know, eat the dust of the earth, and he shall... you shall bruise his heel and he shall crush your head and all of that. I thought that's when Satan was cast out. Well, that was an assumption on my part. I never had a pastor teach me one way or another. So, I'm teaching you now.
Kind of the only thing would come up, like you had mentioned in Job. Like, whoa, that's interesting. You know, Satan.
Yeah.
Came to God and was accusing.
Well, and if you're studying the book of Job, that would be an interesting question to say, well, if Job was cast out in Genesis, like we kind of generally assume, that's the assumption by most Christians, I think, and Lutherans, then how would Satan be able to converse with God in the book of Job? So there's another possibility where it might come up in teaching, but how often do you study the book of Job? Not very often.
We did for 2 years.
Yeah, I know. There was a couple of vicars, right? Yeah, that was a long haul, wasn't it? Getting through Job. I think I would have fast-forwarded and tried to get through the whole thing in about 9 months. That would have been my attempt. All right, so John is standing on the sea. I divided chapter 13 into two halves. This is the bigger half. I apologize, but this is kind of a natural breaking point right here. So on the screen, I have chapter 13, verses 1 through 9. And I don't know why there's this white bar at the top. I apologize, but it's there. So a little bit longer of the half, and the second half of the chapter we'll do next. So can I have a volunteer to read these two paragraphs?
And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive to captivity, he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints.
All right, thank you. This is the first of two beasts. So, the dragon is now making war against the woman and her offspring, against the church and Christians. And John is standing on the shore of the sea, and he sees a beast rising out of the sea. The second half of chapter 13, he's going to see a second beast, which we'll get into in a minute. Well, not just a minute. Half an hour or so. What's the sea represent? Do you remember what the sea represents to the people of Israel? Let's see if my pen works here.
Terror and confusion and...
Yes. Terror, confusion, I would use the word chaos. The sea is uncontrollable. You can't tame it. You don't know what's in it. You don't know what's going to happen. Storms come up or not. It can be it can be calm, it can be stormy, and at a moment's notice. The sea represents chaos to ancient peoples, even to us today a little bit, I would say. I mean, you can go sailing out on Lake Michigan, and all of a sudden a storm comes up, and you're in trouble. So I saw a beast rising out of the sea, and this beast has 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 diadems. What's a diadem?
Crown.
Crown, right, 10 crowns. Now these three attributes, 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 diadems. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
We read that last week. Those are attributes of the dragon. The dragon also has 10 horns. What is a horn? Power. Horn represents power. 10, one of the numbers of completeness. 10 horns. He's got power, this beast does. Heads, what's a head represent? Authority. Authority over things. And again, 7, one of the numbers of completeness. 7, 10, and 12, numbers of completeness. 7 heads. And 10 diadems. What's a crown represent? Kingship, right? Glory is the word I would use. It represents that glory that is really rightly due to God. And again, 10, the number of completeness. So this beast has the attributes of the dragon. And as we find out, to it the dragon gave his power. The dragon is delegating some of his power to this beast. Okay? That's what this represents. And blasphemous names on its head. What does it mean? What is blasphemy?
To try to humiliate.
To try to humiliate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Say bad things.
Say bad things? Yeah. False things?
About God.
About God.
About God, against God, yeah. That can be blasphemy. Here is, there are like two main definitions of blasphemy. The second one is to say things against God or about God that are false. So that is true. All of you are kind of hitting on that. The primary definition of blasphemy is the one that was used against Jesus by the high priests. When they had Jesus on trial during Holy Week, and there was very brief conversation. Some, for much of the time, Jesus was silent. Then there was a little bit of conversation, and the priest tore his robes and declared, "Blasphemy! You have heard it yourself. This man has declared blasphemy because
he said he was God.
He called himself God. To put yourself in the place of God is blasphemy, as well as to speak false things about God or to God is also blasphemy. What is this beast trying to do, much like the dragon before it? Putting himself in the place of God. 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 diadems. God is the one who's powerful. God is the one who has authority over all things. All glory, 10 diadems, all glory belongs to God, not to the dragon and not to the beast. So it is being blasphemous. Okay? Just like we saw last week with the dragon. The dragon tried to put himself in the place of God. This beast, like the dragon to whom he reports, his boss, so to speak, is also trying to put himself in the place of God. Verse 2, "And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority." See, there's power, there's throne, and there's authority. That's the horn, the heads, and the diadems in a different order. So it's the same thing. The beast is giving that. Now, this beast is kind of an amalgamation of different things. A leopard, a bear, and a lion. What do all those things mean? Well, Daniel, in the book of Daniel, also had a vision of Judgment Day. It's another one of those books where we get a little glimpse of Judgment Day. And Daniel saw four beasts that came out and pursued God's people. And those four beasts were a leopard, a bear, a lion, and then the fourth beast was unnamed. It was assumed to be a human figure. Okay, but it's unnamed in Daniel. So here, what this is doing is this is pointing out that John is seeing a beast, which is an amalgamation or a combination of the same four beasts that Daniel saw in his vision. They are related visions. Okay? Now, in Daniel, what did these four beasts represent? It's actually explained. I'm not going to go back there because we'd have to read a chapter or so to kind of see it all. It's in Daniel chapter 7. I don't know. Should we go there? We'll just explain it to you. It's Daniel 7, 1 to 7, if you want to see it. There's four beasts there. And it becomes pretty clear that those four beasts in Daniel represent Babylon, Persia, and Greece. And the unnamed fourth beast, the undescribed fourth beast, is a power that is rising in the West, Rome. So it's known in Daniel, to the readers of Daniel, that the four beasts which are pursuing God's people back then in Daniel are those four great world powers that successively succeeded one another. Babylon succeeded by Persia, which then went to Greece, and then Greece was about to be soon superseded by Rome, right after the time of Daniel, a few centuries after the time of Daniel. So that's what the four beasts back then were. This is one giant beast which represents all four of those. This beast, this first beast rising out of the sea, it represents secular or political or governmental power. Okay? That's what this beast represents. We know that because this beast that has these different attributes is reflecting the beasts of Daniel, and we know that's what that represented. So, are God's people, the church, sometimes, I'd say quite frequently, persecuted or tormented by governmental or secular or political powers? Yeah, they are. That's the answer. And I think that's true today, too. Sadly, I think it's growing again. It may ebb and flow a little bit. There may be times in history and locations in the world where governmental powers or secular powers are more strong and in their persecution of the church or less strong, but it's always there to some extent. And there certainly are periods of history where it is stronger, where the secular powers are tormenting the church. I think we can point to various political authorities throughout history after the time of Daniel that would represent this, that would reflect this. Of course, at the time of Daniel, this was Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Then after that time, we had Caesars, various Caesars in the Roman Empire, who persecuted God's people, the church. And especially two come to mind, which I don't know how much world history you remember or whatever, but Caligula and Nero were known for their brutal persecution of Christians. And then they used government power to do it. Under the authority of the government, they sought out and captured and tortured and executed Christians. Fed them to the lions, the whole bit. They were given as toys to the gladiators for sport. You know, all of that. After that time, the next group that comes to mind for me is some of the corrupt kings of the Middle Ages, who again were very much in confrontation with the church and with God's people. They would do what they want to do. I think the next group of most obvious, perhaps secular, political, governmental powers that would torture the church, I think I would jump forward to the dictators of the early 20th century. Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Mao Zedong, Tojo, all of those dictators who were very openly anti-church, anti-God, anti-Christian, and persecuted the church underneath their political authority. I think we can jump to a modern day one. No, I'm not talking about America. I don't want to get into politics in America, although some of that might apply here. But I'm actually thinking of ISIS, the modern-day caliphate. And they, under the guise of their governmental authority, are trying to expand their influence and their control and develop, once again, reinstate what they consider to be a Muslim caliphate throughout the Middle East. And as they expand their influence, what do they do with Christians? Off with their head. They're tortured and slaughtered. And a lot of the refugees that are flowing out of the Middle East, not all, but a big chunk of them, are Christians trying to escape the torture. We should be helping those people, shouldn't we?
Well, that reminds me of the devotion that Pastor Klaus had last night, where he talked about the Christians on the same bus with the Muslims and trying to escape. And the ISIS was there to shoot any Christian that was on it. But the Muslims on that bus gave them their clothes and everything. And in other words, it was a sign of loving your enemies.
All right. Here's a short paragraph from Dr. Brighton, kind of explaining these first couple of verses. In John's day and long after, the beast of chapter 13, 1 and 2 did indeed represent Rome. After the fall of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, Rome continued to serve as the type and model of tyrannical powers that would arise in the future. In light of this history, the interpretation includes Rome, but also must be broadened. This beast represents and symbolizes every human authority and everything of the human nature that the dragon can corrupt and control and use in his warfare against the woman, the church, and her seed, individual Christians. It includes, Dr. Brighton says, this beast wraps into it, includes political, governmental, social, economic, philosophical, and educational systems that the devil corrupts against the church.
Scary.
That's kind of eye-opening to me, too, because I have long thought that our educational system, higher educational system, is skewing against Christians.
Yes.
And that's, Dr. Brighton says that here as well. And that's part of this beast is against Christians. And, you know, social and economic institutions that are against Christians, too. Philosophical institutions, systems that are against Christianity. That's a battle, and many of you know that I have a little bit of a interest in apologetics, and so I sometimes get into some of these, I read the books or get into little discussions with people about worldviews. And the worldviews of the most people today in our society is no longer a Christian worldview. Our worldviews are skewing into the New Age and against Christianity. So there's another philosophical system which is being corrupted by the devil, the dragon, and this beast. Okay. Verse 3. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. A mortal wound. It's got 7 heads. One of them is mortally wounded, but it's healed. What does that represent? Every time one of these tyrannical powers in a government, in a social system, in an educational system, every time one of these tyrannical powers is killed, what happens? Another one rises in its place. Okay? So, that's what this is. And the whole world marveled as they followed the beast. So many people today, non-Christians especially, maybe even some Christians get sucked into the ideas of following these corrupt institutions and systems which are anti-Christian, okay, against the church. All right, there we see it right there in verse 3. And verse 4, it gets worse. They don't just follow the beast. They worshipped the dragon. For he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? They're worshipping the dragon, and they're worshipping the dragon's beast. Wow. Does this make you think of anything? People who put their hope and their trust in their economic might, in their education, in their governmental programs, in their social programs, that's what they trusted. Oh, we can solve the problems of the world, the ills of society, if we only did better education, or more social programs, or bigger government. I'm not trying to advocate for or against government, but Many government programs are anti-Christian. And we shouldn't put our hope in those things. Where should our hope be? In God, in Christ alone, absolutely. And so it's wrong to put our hope in those things. Now, does God want us to have a good government that's not corrupt for our own protection? Yes, he wants that. Does God want us to have a fair economic system that's not biased against one group of people or another? Yes, of course he does. Does God want us to have an honest educational system that will properly teach and train our children and ourselves? Of course he does. They're all corrupted by the beast, and we end up worshiping those systems. I see that a lot today. You guys too?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's what's going on right here. And this last phrase, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? The people who are worshiping the dragon and the beast are the ones saying this. Who is like the beast and who can fight against it? That's reminiscent. Maybe it rings a bell in your mind. Because that is what is said about God. Michael, the archangel, the name Michael means who is like God. Who is like God? So you think about Michael going to war against the dragon. His very name means who is like God. No one can defeat him. Who is like the beast? Who can fight against it? This phrase is a claim against God. There's a blasphemous statement right there, claiming that the dragon and the beast is as good as God. Who's like the beast? No one. Yeah, there is someone like the beast. It's God and his son Jesus who is like the beast. And they can fight against the beast. But these people are so blinded in their worship and their adoration of the dragon and the beast that they claim the beast is God, which is what the beast wants up here because he's putting himself in the place of God. You see how twisted and corrupt this is?
Just like today.
This is our world today. Right. This is our world today. Yes, Arlene?
In the notes, it does say that they form a counterfeit anti-Trinity.
Yes, I'm going to get there. Very good. Yep. Nope, that's fine. We're going to see, because the second beast arises. And so what Arlene is referring to, and it's in the Lutheran Study Bible, so you may have seen it, the dragon, the first beast, and the second beast. And they all claim to be God. That's an anti-Trinity. So I will talk about that a little bit more when we get into the second half of this chapter. I got to hustle because we're on verse 4 and we got 40 minutes to go. All right. Verse 5, and the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. There's that number again. We see this same number coming up in three chapters in a row. And they're all the same number, 1,260 days, 42 months, 3.5 years. They're all the same time frame, and they all refer to the New Testament era, the church era, from the time of Christ until Judgment Day. That's what this represents. So the beast is given a mouth uttering blasphemous words. Yeah, we see the blasphemous words right here in verse 4. Who is like the beast and who can fight against him? That's blasphemy. And it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. So, first of all, just laying a little bit of groundwork for a month or so from now, all those people who get into all of the rapture stuff and the timelines and the dispensationalism, and they start to sign these time frames with specific things on earth. Well, what's going to happen for 42 months? No, it's a symbolic number. It's the same number as 1260 days and 3.5 years. It's a symbolic number representing the church age. People get all worked up about these numbers, but that's what that number means. Okay, here again. In verse 6, it opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. I don't think I need to say much about that. And it was allowed to make war on the saints and conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on the earth will worship it. I'm going to pause right there. It is allowed to make war on the saints and conquer them. It is allowed. Huh. What's that mean?
God is allowing them to do it.
They're allowed by God. Right. Yes. Much like Satan was allowed by God to test Job so far, but no farther. And why was Job tested? To test his faith. To strengthen him in faith. to display his faith to others. It's an evangelism thing as well. This beast is allowed to make war on us and to conquer us. Are we conquered by some of these corrupt secular systems that we've mentioned? Yes, we are conquered by them. It's allowed by God. Why? Well, we don't always know in specific instances, but in general, it's allowed. God allows it to test us, to test our faith, to strengthen us in faith, to maybe display our strength of faith to other people as a mission or as an evangelism to other people. Wow, look at them. It draws people in. Those are three reasons. There could be more that God allows this to happen. The good news is, though, it's allowed by God, meaning he's in control. And he will only allow it to go so far, but no farther. He will be with us. He will comfort us. I mean, you're right down here. You can see there's that last sentence of this first half of the chapter. A call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Remember, that's the whole theme of Revelation, right there. Here it is again. We see it coming up over and over and over again. And all who dwell on earth will worship it. Remember, we're still talking about the first beast. Are there people who worship the government? Yeah. Yeah, there are. And all who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb who was slain. Those of us who are God's children, our names have been written in the book of life by the Lamb who was slain. We will not worship this beast or the dragon that controls it. Okay? We are tempted to sometimes, perhaps. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. And what's this verse mean? 10. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. What does that sound like? What does that maybe make you think of?
War.
What's that? War? Yeah, it does make you think of war. And there is war going on here. Absolutely. But if anyone is to be taken captive, who's the anyone?
Us,
if we're to be taken captive by the beast, we're going to be taken captive by the beast. If we are to be slain by the sword, we're going to be slain by the sword.
We have to have perseverance.
We have to have perseverance, because that's the immediate next sentence here, is the call for endurance of the saints. This also refers to not us, but the other side, the enemies, the people who worship the beast. If they are destined to be taken captive, into captivity they will go. This verse right here is a little poem, a one-verse poem. It's set that way in the text in most Bibles. And it's a poem that's pointing to the fact that God is in control over all things. And that we are predestined for what we are predestined for. And God knows. And we don't. So while we strive for and long to escape the persecution of the beast and the war that is upon us, we strive to avoid that. Nevertheless, if God has predetermined that we will be taken captive or slain by the sword, it's going to happen. If he has predetermined that any of the enemies at a given point in time will be taken captive or slain by the sword, it will happen. This is a little bit of a verse that just say, I mean, to delve into some of those philosophical systems, fate. It's God's determination. It will happen. And so, on the one hand, that's good news for us. On the other hand, it's kind of sad news for us, because we can't escape the persecution that's coming. You can't escape the persecution, but God will be there. He's predetermined that he will save you and rescue you through it. So it's kind of one of those good news, bad news situations. I got another quote for you on this very verse from Dr. Brighton in this commentary. He says this. It's a couple sentences long. Dr. Brighton is talking about this very verse, verse 10. Especially then will Christians be tempted to take things into their own hands. But the Spirit of God warns the Christian not to do so. Rather, accept what God allows, even if it is or seems to be cruel and unjust. Do not resist it. No human being can stand against the beast nor control it, since on earth is not his equal. For in God's governance, the woman is destined to suffer the warfare of the beast. To whatever degree captivity and being killed come upon the Christian, and whatever form of imprisonment and martyrdom take, the Christian is to suffer them patiently in faith for the sake of the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. I have a feeling that that is the attitude of the martyrs of old. In the first and second and third century under Caligula and Nero, when they were slaughtered in masses, they would root out the Christians and use them for sport, blood sport. And they often just, it was attested to by various ancient historians of the time that these Christians, for the most part, aren't even fighting back. They're just, okay, if you're going to kill me, you're going to kill me. I know I'll be in a better place. They just kind of submitted to it. Wow, what kind of great strength of faith does that take? I'd fight back. I would. I don't know if that's wrong or not. Perhaps it is, based on this verse. If I'm supposed to be martyred and slain, God said, you know, it's under God's control, so be it. I know I've got a better end waiting for me. Let him take my life. Take my life and let it be. Consecrated, Lord, to thee. Right.
Maybe you have to fight before your...
Perhaps.
You know.
Perhaps. Yeah, I don't know. That's what this verse is talking about. It sounds a little strange, I suppose.
Well, I was thinking about what has the Powerball lottery got into people's heads today, you know, Christians and everything. Think of the, well, I could take that if I won it, and man, I could pay for the whole Luther Church, Missouri Synod.
You know what? That's. I think you're right. That Powerball, that's trusting in something other than God. No, I'm not going to condemn somebody who buys one or two tickets just for fun and says, you know, it's just, or if you're in an office pool and they buy a half a dozen tickets for fun in the office and they stick them on the bulletin board. Yeah, it's probably not okay.
But that's a drawing card.
But it might draw you in deeper. That's true. Yeah. It might be kind of a gateway in. I definitely know that people who kind of get obsessed with it, and, oh, I got to win, and then I'll solve all my problems, and I buy 50 tickets, and I, you know, then all, and they get all obsessed with it. You're trusting in something other than God. Plus, I mean, really, just be realistic. Your chance of winning is 1 in 300 million. I mean, come on. It's not going to happen. But you're right, Rich. That's one of these secular institutions, i.e. the lottery or an economic system, which we falsely place trust in, that's corrupted by the devil. You're right. All right, and then he ends down here. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. This war that is thrust upon us, it's allowed by God to some extent. We must endure and keep strong in the faith. We know the glorious end. It's already been determined. There's no changing that. We just have to endure through this middle part, the tough part. It is tough. That's the overall theme of Revelation. Once again, and here it's very plain. It's been fairly plain throughout these chapters, but right here as well. Endure. We must endure. We must persevere and remain strong in faith. All right. That's the first half of chapter 13. I sped up a little bit. I think we sort of got caught up on our time. But time for a question or two before we go to the second half of the chapter. Arlene?
Where it says that in chapter 6, that it sounds like the devil even has some control over the saints in heaven, the ones who dwell in heaven. Or am I misunderstanding?
In chapter 6? In verse 6. It opened its mouth to our blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. He's not in heaven blaspheming them. He's blaspheming them down here on earth. And to whom is he blaspheming?
God.
Not to us.
Oh,
to us. Before Satan was cast out of heaven, prior to Christ's victory on the cross and in the ascension, Satan's primary job was to blaspheme us or to accuse us before God. Remember, I used the analogy last week of a courtroom. God the Father is the judge. Satan is the prosecuting attorney. We are the defendant, and he's trying to prosecute us before God. And who is our defender?
Jesus
is our defender. I mean, it's a legal kind of courtroom illustration that fits what's going on. So, Satan is before the judge, accusing us. You know how bad they are? You know what they did? They can't be saved. They must be cast into hell, into prison forever, which is what he wants, because he controls hell or prison. He's in prison. Hell. And, of course, Jesus has won the victory. He's won the trial. And the devil, the prosecuting attorney, has been declared in contempt of court, kicked out of court forever. So the devil can no longer accuse us before God. So now what does he do? He accuses us to ourselves. You're not good enough. What makes you think you're good enough? God won't save you. Jesus doesn't really love you. He did all that for other people. That's not for you. You're a horrible, terrible person. That's what the devil now does. He tries to accuse us to ourselves. He's blaspheming us to ourselves, or saying blasphemies to us. That's what he's accusing. You know, one of his primary tricks is, same thing he did to Eve. He can no longer talk to God, but he can talk to you and I. He says, don't you want to be like God? God doesn't know what's... Look at it. God's letting you suffer through all this way. If you take control of your own life, if you do what you want, you'll be in control. You'll be better off. That's a blasphemy, because he's trying to convince us to put ourselves in the place of God. He's trying to convince us to trust in our own actions rather than trust in God's actions. So it's a blasphemy which the devil is uttering to us here on earth. Okay? After the time of his expulsion from heaven. Does that make sense?
Well, what confuses me, though, is that is those who dwell in heaven.
Those who dwell in heaven. Let me look back at it again. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Yeah, he's blaspheming those who dwell in heaven to us here on earth.
Okay.
He's trying to corrupt our image of the saints who have gone before us. Oh, you know those relatives of yours who were, you know, you thought they were faithful Christians? Guess what? They weren't. Why do you think they can be in heaven, you know? Your grandparents, or, you know, Martin Luther. You honestly think he's in heaven? He's not in heaven. He's a horrible man. You know, he's a sinner. I'll point out some things to you on how he sinned. That's what the devil's doing. He's blaspheming, he's corrupting, he's accusing the saints in heaven to us. Trying to corrupt our vision of the saints who have gone before. That's what I think that's referring about, about those in heaven. That was the phrase exactly. He's blaspheming those who dwell in heaven. It doesn't mean he's in heaven doing it to them, but he's doing it about them. Was there another question? Ellen?
You know, some years ago we had a case where a high schooler went to court and had a picture of Jesus removed from the high school because it offended him.
Oh, boy.
And they removed it.
Okay.
And I always felt like if Christians had stood up,
yeah,
and cross-filed in the court, you know, maybe they could have.
Yeah.
Could have said, we want it there. If he doesn't like it, don't look at it. You know?
Yeah, right.
But is this verse in there saying that we should not fight back like that?
Yeah, see, I was afraid that question would come up. Because I think on the one hand, we are called to fight against the devil, to resist him, to fight in this war. But I think, on the other hand, we are to take note of this verse 10 here and say, but whatever the outcome is, God has already determined. The way I think of it is this way. I was explaining this to someone else back a number of months ago who was, you know, in the whole gun control thing, and should we have guns, or should we, you know, self-defense, and, you know, ourselves, or as a nation, send our armies to defend some, but the whole, I mean, it's kind of the same topic. Do we fight or not? We're not peaceniks, really, right? Pacifists. Here's, I think, the way I've kind of resolved it in my own mind as a pastor. We submit to the destiny God has already determined for ourselves, but we defend our fellow Christians. So if I defend you in a court of law or across the fence or in society to say, you have a right to this, to worship the way you want, to believe in God, to have a picture of Jesus on the wall. I defend you, and you in turn, in maybe other matters, defend me. But, on the other hand, Jesus, he submitted to the authorities, even though they were corrupt, Pontius Pilate and Herod, he submitted to the authorities and allowed them to execute himself. If I'm directly confronted as a pastor with martyrdom someday, not too far-fetched, I'll just say, well, okay, one person, I can't stop it. Oh, well. But on the other hand, if one of you are confronted with martyrdom, I will try and be there in the court of law to defend you or whatever I need to do. So that's the way I kind of resolve this issue. Do we fight against the devil in this social war, that's cultural war that's going on? Yes. But on the other hand, we submit to the knowledge that God has already predetermined everything. So when the outcome is apparent against me, well, I'll submit to it. But when the outcome is not apparent and it's against you, I'm going to fight on your behalf to defend you as a fellow Christian, a brother in Christ. Does that make sense? That's the clearest I can get for that answer, because that is a tough question. That is a tough question. Do we submit or do we fight? And I think it's kind of a little of each. Little of each.
If we don't say anything, what does that say about our faith?
Yeah, no, sure. You're right. If we don't say anything, what does that... Yeah, that says something, too. Sure. All right. Let's finish up chapter 13 here. Fortunately, it's not quite as long. All right. This is the last two paragraphs, verses 11 through 18. Get a volunteer to read this.
Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast. It deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it is allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and buy or sell, free or slave, to be marked on the first hand or the forehead, so that no one can number of its name. The calls for the wisdom, let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is a number of a man, and his number is 666.
Yep, 666. All right, let me go through it. Then I saw another beast. Okay, so here's the second beast. Not rising out of the sea, but rising out of where?
Earth.
The earth. So these two beasts have authority over all of creation, sea and earth. Okay? Now what's different about the earth? The earth is the dwelling place of man, humans, humankind. And this one has two horns, so it has power, but it's not talked about in those ferocious terms of a leopard, a bear, and a lion, but this one is
a lamb.
A lamb. What is a lamb an image of? Who uses the image of a lamb?
Christ.
Christ.
We're the lamb.
What might this beast refer to?
The Antichrist.
The Antichrist. False teaching within the church. Churchly authority that is corrupted. The first beast was secular authority. The second beast is churchly authority. This is one of the reasons why Luther railed against the Pope so much as the Antichrist, because he misused and abused his power. And at the time of Luther, I think it's better now, but at the time of Luther, there were a string of popes who were outright corrupt. They would buy and sell churchly influence to the highest bidder in order to make themselves rich. And under the guise of that would lead people astray within the church. It made Luther furious. And just think about it. What started the whole Reformation?
selling of indulgences, selling forgiveness for the purpose of building St. Peter's Cathedral. That's corruption right there, and it was under the knowledge of the Pope. That's what got Luther so upset. That's what's going on here. Two horns, so it has power, horns, power, like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It's got the authority of the dragon, but it's got the appearance of a lamb. Ooh, that's sneaky. What did Jesus say about a wolf in sheep's clothing? That rings true right here. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. So it's in league with the first beast. They are united in their war upon the woman and her offspring, upon the church, God's faithful, and Christians. And there's that word worship again. Worship's the first beast. Can you think in times of history where religious authority was combined with secular authority at the demise and detriment of God's people? Well, again, I'll just list a few of them, same, kind of the same ones. In Rome, the Caesar was considered to be a god. Religious authority as well as secular authority, both corrupt, were united in the person of Caesar. Again, Caligula and Nero being ideal examples of that, a couple of the worst Caesars. In the Middle Ages, there was a constant struggle and collusion between the kings and the papacy. They struggled with each other about who had higher authority, and they would validate each other. The popes are the ones who would crown the kings. The kings were the ones who would elect the pope. So there was a collusion going on there, an intermix between them. One of the hallmarks kind of Lutheran theology is this understanding of the two kingdoms, right? Kingdom of the right, kingdom of the left. Kingdom of government, kingdom of the church. And we want the government out of our business. And we generally, as a church, stay out of government business, with a few exceptions, scriptural exceptions, abortion, gay marriage, which are very clear in scripture. But in terms of, I know Lutherans in general, our congregation specifically, and most of us individually probably lean more conservative politically. I know there are, it's not all true, but that's probably true. But I'm going to say that God can work with any form of government, whether it's a more progressive socialistic government or whether it's a more capitalistic form of government, and both can be corrupted. Both can be wrongly worshipped. And I'll take a moment just to skewer both sides. Okay? I had a seminary professor who did this. Obviously, those who are on the far left in our country, they want bigger government. They want to trust in government. They want to rely on government. And that's the wrong place for our trust. We should not be trusting in government or relying upon government. Also, as soon as you get bigger government, of course, there's a tendency to get more corruption in power. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So there is a theological concern on the left. The same thing is true on the right. Those who are on the right generally would want smaller government, more freedoms, more capitalistic measures. Well, there's a problem there, because now people tend to trend into greed, and they tend to oppress those beneath them. Those who are needy or homeless or hungry will oftentimes be neglected or forgotten. Just think of like the Victorian age, when the homeless would run the streets uncared for. And who cared for them in that age before the rise of big government? Who cared for those people? Not the capitalists on the right, not the socialists, liberals on the left. The church did. And what is the church still responsible to do? Care for the poor and the homeless. That's our job. And in some cases, we're neglecting it. In some cases, we're not. That's what we need to strive to do. So there is a problem, a theological, scriptural problem on both sides of the political spectrum. But here is a sign where the two beasts work in concert. Okay, the religious authority and the secular authority, both working to try to kind of corrupt God's people. Where was I? Oh, I was, sorry. I got on my soapbox there for a minute. Some other examples of religious authority and secular authority getting mixed. Hitler used religious authority and corrupted the church of his time in order to put additional pressure on the people and
force them into submission. Okay? Part of his control over the people at the time was a religious fervor. Right? And I would say, again, I'll go to the modern day ISIS, the Islamic Caliphate. They control their people not only through secular authority, but also through religious fervor. Right? You see that again in kind of the false religion of Islam in the Middle East, that they use both forms of authority, secular and religious, in concert to try and corrupt and control their people. That's the two beasts working in concert. Okay, verse 13. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. Great signs. John uses the word signs in reference to Jesus' miracles. So here, miracles are performed by this false religion, by this Antichrist, is performing miracles. Sometimes do supernatural things happen that we can't explain but don't seem to be from God? That happens sometimes for the purpose of fooling people. Even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. What does that make you think of? Who did that?
Elijah.
When he was battling against whom? The prophets of Baal. And there's 400 prophets of Baal on one side and Elijah on the other. And they had a contest, remember? Who can pray to your God and make fire come down from heaven? And the prophets of Baal could do nothing, of course, it's a false god. And Elijah, douse it with water. Douse it again. Douse it again with water. Okay, it's thoroughly drenched. And he starts to pray, God, will you show these people you're the true God? And down comes the bolt of fire. And burns up the whole altar and everything. Well, here it's saying, again, this second beast is trying to replicate or put itself in the place of God, performing miracles that would seem to mimic what God can do. Here's another example from the Bible. When Moses was talking to Pharaoh about the plagues, you remember what the first two plagues were? First one was water into blood. Second one was frogs. Both of the first two, Pharaoh immediately rejected because his magicians of the day, they were probably black sorcerers, you know, black magic kind of, you know, they could do the same thing. Pharaoh rejected them. If you read the story, the third plague, it clearly says, Moses brought about the third plague, which was flies, and Pharaoh's magicians could not duplicate it. So the point is, the first two were signs that were duplicated by evil forces, satanic work. And that's what's going on here as well. They're performing great signs, trying to trick the people, fool the people. 14. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth. See, there again is allowed. God allows it to happen for some purpose of his own, to a certain extent. God is allowing this to happen. And these signs that this beast is performing deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. Drawing people into false worship. Drawing people into false worship. Okay, worshiping this beast. Verse 15, and it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. So here, this second beast is speaking and trying to slay those who will not worship it. Brings to mind for me Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. All those who will not, when you hear the music, you must bow down to the golden statue. And if you don't, you'll be cast into the fiery furnace. That's a little bit of what's going on here. One of the commentators, I think it was Dr. Brighton, mentions that it was well known in ancient history that one of the miraculous phenomena that was considered to be validating for a religion, a false religion, was if statues would speak. Well, is that part of what's going on here? Yeah, it might be. The image of the beast might even speak. Could that be a reference to this phenomena of false religions having statues that speak? Well, I don't know. Were they really speaking, or was it in people's minds? Yeah, I don't know. But there's false things going on here, false worship that's going on. 16. Also, it causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. Huh. Both great and small, poor and rich, free and slave, to be marked. Are we marked? Marked by whom?
Christ.
With what sign? In baptism, with the sign of the cross. We are marked. Does Satan see that? And he says, I'm going to do the same thing to my people. He's going to mark his people too. All those who follow the dragon and the beast are also marked. Where are they marked? On the right hand or the forehead. What does that mean? Our mark, is our mark visible to people? Immediately visible?
No.
No. Your baptism, the sign of the cross placed upon you, it's an invisible mark. This mark of the beast is also an invisible mark. What goes on in your head? It's not meant to be a rhetorical question. That's where our thoughts are, right? That's where your thinking is. What is your hand used for? Doing things. So how does the beast mark you? By corrupting your thoughts and your actions to coincide with what he wants. That's the mark of the beast. Corruption of your thoughts and your actions. That's what he's doing here. And when if you don't have the mark of the beast, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. I've got a really recent example, I think, of this happening, and I think it would continue. It probably has happened throughout history in very different ways or small ways. But what I'm thinking of right now, this will ring true, or you guys will all be familiar with this. That couple that is a florist out in Oregon.
Yes.
And they're driven out of business because they won't sell flowers for a gay couple having their wedding. So they don't have the right thinking. Their thoughts aren't politically correct. Their thoughts aren't in alignment with what the beast is promoting. And therefore, they are not allowed to buy or sell. They've been driven out of business by that, I'm going to say, politically correct thinking. That, well, how can you not sell to a gay couple? You claim that's against your religion? Well, that's not valid. You're a public, you know, business. You need to bow your values, and your thinking as a Christian needs to be subservient to our, what we would claim, greater ideal of gay marriage. Well, no, that's against my thing. You know, our nation used to allow individual rights, but apparently it doesn't anymore. Apparently you have to walk in lockstep with whatever the greater powers, the beast, thinks, or else you won't be allowed to do business.
Well, there are probably a lot of people there who agree, but they're afraid to say so.
Probably.
Same thing might happen to them.
Gets brought up with your question from before about do we fight, or if we would fight in court, mm-hmm. defend one another and all that. Yeah.
So I just saw something in the paper about how they were castigating this one official because he didn't agree with, I don't remember exactly what it was anymore, but something we are definitely against. And they said, most of the people in his area agree with it. And I thought, they probably don't. You just think they do.
Yeah.
Or it's to your advantage to say it.
Sure. Right. And I know there were other instances. I thought there was a pizza place down in Indiana someplace that would sell pizza to a gay couple or something. And so then they were also castigated and they're being attempted to run out of business, that kind of thing. That's modern days. Kind of small example, I mean, just a small business, but nevertheless, it's somebody's business. I think that's what's going on here. No one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. What is the mark? The right thinking and the right actions according to what the beast thinks. If you don't comply with what the beast thinks, you won't be able to conduct business. What's that?
Hitler and Judaism.
Hitler and Judaism. See, that's a good example. The same thing from a century ago, that Jews would not be allowed to conduct business unless they, because they didn't agree with Hitler's idea. Now, that didn't really involve Christians, because Hitler wasn't a Christian.
No.
Jews aren't Christians.
No.
But nevertheless, we need to defend the right
to think and believe what you want. So I don't know what Christians or Lutherans at the time of Hitler would have defended the Jews. I would have hoped there would have been some. But yes, you're right. That's another example.
Well, I think there's a rumor going around about all the meat has to be blessed by Halal or whatever they call that.
Yeah. Oh, for the Muslims.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I've heard a little bit about that too. Well, that might be getting part of this. If you're a butcher and you don't want to participate in that, then maybe at some point you'll be driven out of business. Yeah. All right. Hey, we're going to finish here in just a few minutes. So that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. Verse 18. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Okay, you already know some numbers. The number 3 represents God, the Trinity. The number 4 represents creation, God's creation, north, south, east, west, four seasons, etc. Number 7, 10, and 12 are numbers of completeness. The number 6 is the number of man. It represents two things. Number 6 represents man. Man was created on which day? The sixth day. Man is to work for how many days a week?
6 days.
How many of us do anymore? We're supposed to work 6 days. 6 is the number of man. Who's the one, ultimately, that rebelled against God? Adam. Man. So 6 also not only is the number of man, but has also become associated in the Bible with the number for rebellion or incompleteness. Because when mankind rebelled, we lost the divine image. We are now incomplete until Christ restores us. Another way to think of it is 7 is a number of completeness. How many days in a week? 7. 6 is incomplete. A 6-day week is incomplete. It's the number of man, and it's also incomplete. So think of 6 both in two ways. 6 is the number of man, as it says right here, the number of a man, 6, and it's also the number of incompleteness or imperfection or rebellion, which mankind brought about. Okay? So that's the number of a man. And what's the number of the beast? 666. 3 times the number of man. Oh, 3. The number of God. So man trying to put himself in the place of God. 3 beasts, the dragon and 2 beasts. 3, there's the anti-trinity coming up. So this number is not some magic number. I know there are some out there who try to do numerology on 666 and they say that this number represents Nero, I think is what they say. I don't remember exactly. Yes, it is true that every letter of the Hebrew and Greek alphabets has a number assigned to it. Okay? They do have numbers assigned to them. And that supposedly if you spell out the name of Nero, the full name of Nero, and then take the numbers associated with the numbers add up to 666. That's getting a little bit of conspiracy theory for me. I mean, it's like, come on. Really, I think what this number 666 means, it's not referring to a specific tyrant in the past or future. It's referring to the 3 times man's number. Man is trying to be in the place of God. And it's also reflecting that man is following the dragon and 2 beasts, the anti-trinity. And the number 6 refers to rebellion or incompleteness. That's the dragon and the 2 beasts are rebellious and imperfect and incomplete. So this number 666 is referring to 2 things. The anti-trinity of the dragon and the 2 beasts, and also the rebelliousness of mankind. Okay, that's what that number is. There's no magic about it. Now, the question here is, this is coming from Dr. Brighton in the commentary I'm reading. This calls for wisdom. What does that refer to? Some would say, well, that means you have to have wisdom to be able to interpret this number. Dr. Brighton disagrees, and he sold me on it after reading a paragraph or so on him explaining it. He's saying, this calls for wisdom. What calls for wisdom? Being able to understand how this applies in your day. Because the anti-trinity, the dragon and the 2 beasts, manifests itself differently in each age of world history. As we've talked about, it was Rome in the early church. At the time John was writing this, it was Rome and the Caesars who were persecuting the church. Then it became the corrupt kings and monarchies and papacy of the Middle Ages. Then it became the corrupt dictators of the early 20th century, late 19th century, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini. Now I think that the wisdom that is required here is that this is now referring to, I think, the Islamic caliphate that's developing in the Middle East and causing worldwide havoc. That's what I think this now refers to, 666. So Dr. Brighton says, when John says here in verse 18, this calls for wisdom, he's saying you need to have wisdom to understand how all of this is manifested in your day and age. I think he's right. Now, could this, also mean this calls for wisdom? You have to have wisdom to understand that number 666. Maybe it means that too, but I'm not sold that's what that word wisdom there is referring to. Okay. Oh, one last little tidbit I wanted to bring up. This was interesting. Some of the same people who... I got a couple other little tidbits here. I didn't notice it. The number six. I talked to you about how it means man. It represents man. Man was created on the sixth day. Man must work for 6 days out of seven. It also refers to imperfection or rebellion. Six is one short of seven, so it would be an imperfect week. Here's other things to help support the idea that the number six represents imperfection or rebellion. Jesus suffered on the cross for 6 hours. We know he was crucified in the third hour, which in the Jewish calculation of time would have been 9 o'clock. And we know he died in the, ninth hour. He died at the ninth hour, which would be 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You guys have heard that before too, right? We often have one of our Good Friday services around that time. So that would be 6 hours. Jesus suffered on the cross for 6 hours. Also, while he was on the cross, the world went dark. At what hour? The sixth hour, which would be noon. Halfway through his time on the cross, the world went dark. So at the sixth hour, the world went dark. Again, just a couple of other little occurrences of the number six that help relate that number to rebellion and imperfection. And then one last one. This is a little bit far-fetched, but I found this kind of interesting. Again, this feeds into some of the conspiracy theorists about Nero and the number 666 meaning Nero. If you take all the letters of the Roman numerals, 1 equals what number? Or I means what number? I equals 1. And let's see, V equals what? 5. And X equals 10. And then what comes next? L. What's L equal?
50.
And then what's next? You come up with C. What's C equal in Roman numbers?
100.
And then the next one is D. What's D equal in Roman numerals? 500. Those are all the letters in the Roman numeral system. If you take one of each and add them up, it equals 666. It doesn't really mean anything. Some people, I think, a little overboard and claim there's proof that the number 666 is talking about the Roman Caesar and Mount Nero. I think that's a little far-fetched. But I thought it was interesting that if you take one of each number of the Roman numeral system, it knocks it up to 666. Kind of interesting. By the way, then the question is, well, where's M? You've seen Roman numerals before, and sometimes, like, if they're on a trademark and they have all the Roman numerals in there, you see M. What's M mean?
1,000.
But M was not... I researched this just a little bit, because it's interesting. Side tidbit that has nothing... Trivia that has nothing to do with anything. M was originally written like this by the Romans when they would do Roman numerals. Two D's... back to back. Two D's. This is a D back to back. Two D's. 500 and 500 is 1,000. And then over usage, as they would hand write, and maybe get a little sloppy in their handwriting, they would write it like this.
two D's back to back. And that became M. So M came to be known in the Roman numeral system as 1,000, but it wasn't one of the original numbers in the Roman numeral system. Okay? Trivia, that means nothing. Kind of, you know, makes you think of this symbol. You guys know where that symbol came from? When the U.S. monetary system was invented, it was a U.S. dollar. U.S. And then people would start writing it so fast, they would just write like this, but that's not quite correct. And then they would abbreviate it even shorter by just doing one vertical line. But the monetary unit of a dollar was invented by the U.S. government, and it was U.S. dollar, right there, like that, U.S. So again, trivia. See, you come to Bible study just to learn trivia. Next time you play Trivial Pursuit, now you can answer that question. All right. I have one short little quote from Dr. Brighton to end with. Before I do that, any questions or comments? How far past time are we? About 10 minutes? 12 minutes? Oh, well. Sorry. All right. Here's a thought from Dr. Brighton. The wisdom referred to at the beginning of verse 18 is the wisdom that comes from God and enables the Christian to know and understand what this holy unholy Trinity is and represents at any given time here on earth. This wisdom enables the Christian to discern how the evil forces of the dragon, both secular and religious, are always and everywhere active, at war to destroy the church and her witness to Christ. Such wisdom comes only from God, but it is a wisdom that he graciously and richly confers on all his people. The point being made here, this is at the very end of this chapter from Dr. Brighton, in fact, it's the last comment he makes on chapter 13, is that this wisdom, in order to understand all of this and how it applies in our day and age, comes from God, and God freely gives us that wisdom so that we can understand the forces that we're fighting against, so that we can have the patience and endurance and perseverance to last through it, and so that our eyes are opened for what's going on around us. That wisdom comes from God. I think that's a little comforting note I can leave you with. God is with you. He will give you the wisdom that's necessary, and he will also fill you with the endurance and the perseverance needed to get through. Rich?
Well, our explanation of the third article, I cannot, by my own reason or strength, believe.
There you go.
It always jumps into my mind when I think of how smart I am.
Well said, and that's a great reference. I cannot, by my own reason or strength. It's God who does it for me. And yes, when we start getting ourselves so old, filled with our own riches, and oh, look how good I am, we have to remind ourselves. It's God's grace that gives us that knowledge, that understanding, that faith, that strength, that endurance. It all comes from God. He's the
That's
one who puts us up.
That's why we're here.
There we go. That's why we're here. Right.
Listening.
All right. Should we rise and close to the Lord's Prayer? Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory. Forever and ever.
Amen. Thanks for coming. See you next week.
Thank you.